Welcome to the Pitchology Podcast with me, your host, Steve DeStante. Discover the best strategies entrepreneurs use to raise capital to help their businesses scale and grow. Hear personal stories of what people did in order to be able to figure out that next level of their business, which required capital. Whether you're a successful entrepreneur or simply aspiring to join the world of entrepreneurship, capital raising is often a very vital part of your growth and success. Welcome, everybody, to this episode of The War and Art of Funding. I'm joined today by Andrew Sherman, who is an attorney, a friend, and an author. He's written a whole bunch of books, one of which is Mergers and Acquisitions from A to Z. And one of my favorites was The Harvesting of Intangible Assets. Welcome, Andrew. How are you today?
I'm doing great, Steve. In fact, if you have a minute, I can explain to your listeners how those two books tie together, because it's kind of interesting, you know, given our focus today on the podcast. It's some people look at the collection of books I've written and they don't naturally see the connection between them, but those two books are very importantly interlinked, and at your convenience, we can talk about them.
Jump right in. I'd love to know the connection between those two books.
Sure. So about, if you don't mind, I'll actually share a funny story.
Sure.
When I first started practicing law in the mid-80s, I worked on my very first M&A deal. And I was a young associate, and I was at the office late, and I was by myself, and I was calculating the Exhibit A, which was the bill of sale on an asset purchase deal, and the purchase price was $500,000. Remember, it was, you know, 80s. And when I totaled up the assets on the purchase price, they came to $485,000. And I started sweating bullets. I was like, oh my God, this might be a fraud. What am I going to do? You know, should I call the senior partner at home at night? I mean, the math is off and we can't close tomorrow. So I sweated all night. I couldn't sleep. I get in the office like 7 a.m. I'm waiting for him to arrive. And I go rushing in his office and I said, you know, we can't close this deal. And he said, what do you mean we can't close the deal? And I said, well, you know, the total assets add up to $485,000 and the purchase price is $500,000. And he said, oh, just put, add a line item to Exhibit A called Goodwill and put down $15,000. And I said, well, what do you mean? Like, what's Goodwill? Isn't that Goodwill Industries, the people that come pick up your old stuff? And he began explaining to me, you know, no, that's kind of, you know, the brand and the relationships and the customer list. And, you know, I was like, okay, if it's, you know, ethically appropriate, I'll do it. And then, of course, I started researching Goodwill. I've been intrigued with Goodwill for nearly 35 years, because back in the 80s, Goodwill was the rounding error. You know, it was the cleanup number, just like I did on that fateful small transaction. But if you look at today's transactions, you've gone from a rounding error, you know, to fix the Exhibit A, to deals like Microsoft buying LinkedIn for $26 billion, and LinkedIn was losing money at the time. And dial forward, that asset's been estimated at today, you know, over $100 billion. So who's the fool, you know, there? Mm. I mean, you buy a company with negative EBITDA, and it winds up being worth four times what it's worth, you know, a couple of years later. So what I learned from that is that these intangible assets, which I feel we are grossly under leveraging as a matter of strategy in corporate America and around the world, end up being some of the most valuable assets in M&A transactions. And my message to your listeners and eventually to your book readers is, look, if you're on the sell side, and you're not harvesting and identifying and inventorying your intangible assets, you're going to leave significant chips on the table. If you're on the buy side, because I know your book will be written for, you know, multiple audiences, if you're on the buy side and you're listening to this podcast, you need to learn to be kind of an intangible asset hunter. You know, where's Waldo? Where are the intangible assets inside this target company? Because you might be buying it for a fraction of what it's really worth if the buyer, if the seller, you know, can't figure out what intangible assets it has. So those two books should really be read together, particularly if you're a company that's thinking about selling itself, say 3 to 5 years from now. You use the harvesting intangible asset book to maximize your enterprise valuation, and then you use the M&A book to, you know, learn how to be an effective seller. But the principles apply to the buy side as well, and really to any private equity fund or bank or source of financing to M&A deals. So that's how the pieces fit together.
Goodwill is sometimes challenging because you want to finance it also, right? And when you're talking to it,
exactly.
Bingo, exactly. And that's the thing, you know, they don't understand intangibles, or as they would say, invisibles, like things that you don't, that don't exist on paper, right?
But here's the problem, Steve. Here's the problem that, and I've talked to hundreds of bankers about this, this quandary. If you look at the profile of today's corporate America, startups, growing companies, gazelles, unicorns, you name it, they're all intangible asset driven. I mean, I have clients that are worth $50 to $100 million, and they probably have under $1 million of hard assets on their balance sheet. I mean, the assets of today's enterprises are lacking the traditional, categories that a bank would consider good collateral. Well, if our entire economy ends up being an information and tangible asset driven economy, where the hell is anybody going to get collateral from? So they either learn to treat these assets as valid collateral that drive enterprise value and drive revenue streams, or, you know, the banking industry is going to be left behind as a dinosaur.
Well, it seems like that might be happening already.
I'm counting on this podcast to move the needle then.
Yeah, well, you know, I've had, as you know, Peter Diamandis. I'm part of like this inner circle of Peters. And, you know, we had a call last week, a Zoom on crypto. And wow, you know, some of the indications of what crypto is doing right now is frightening. If you buy into the whole assumptions that they're making, there may be a conversion to crypto going on right now when we don't even know it.
I don't mind admitting on the air that I have an active Coinbase account, and I do believe in the long-term crypto like everybody else. It's a portion of my assets. I'm not all in on crypto, but it's bigger than crypto. You know, there's the coins, there's the blockchain, there's multiple blockchains, there's the DeFi up and coming, you know, networks. I mean, basically finance is changing before our eyes. And, you know, people are using Bitcoin almost like Bitcoin describes the entire ecosystem, which is, you know, completely wrong. I mean, Bitcoin is one small piece. It's like referring to Apple as the entire ecosystem of technology. I mean, it may be a leading player in the ecosystem, but you know, the price of Bitcoin is very interesting to me, and I have a few of them, but it's not, you know, I'm monitoring the blockchain, I'm monitoring various cryptocurrencies, I'm monitoring Ethereum very carefully, I'm monitoring these DeFi networks. I mean, there's a lot of moving parts, and to your point, very few of these companies have any tangible assets that we would view through a 1980s or 90s lens as viable collateral.
Exactly. And so there are companies out there that need funding. They're getting acquired by others, and you specialize in that. That's one of your specialty areas. And so the book is all about the variety of ways that entrepreneurs can fund their businesses. And you know, we've talked to venture capitalists. I was on the phone with one of the interviews was Peter Diamandis, and he talked about SPACs. You know, we've got Reg A Plus now, you know, with the increase in the Jobs Act numbers now, you could do a your crowdfunding at $5 million, which is pretty substantial considering. And so in your world, your primary focus is mergers and acquisitions. Is that right?
Yeah, I would categorize it ever so slightly differently, but yes, you're 100% right. I set out in the 80s after being an entrepreneur and dropping out of college to support entrepreneurs and business growth. And eventually, I didn't realize I would be doing this, but eventually even Fortune 500 companies. And the way I think of myself, Steve, although no one, you know, there is no title for this in the law, is I'm a growth strategies attorney. Now, you can't introduce yourself that way. There is no growth strategies department inside big law. So you have to settle into a category. So one of the primary ways that companies grow is through M&A and joint ventures and, you know, business format franchising. And so I've written books and have developed my expertise in the methodologies in which enterprise value is grown. And I've, you know, not just legally, but strategically have been fascinated with the dynamics of business growth my entire career. So I do consider myself an M&A and deals lawyer because that's the nomenclature that people understand. But if you really want to know me and unpeel the onion another level, I would consider myself a business growth strategy lawyer. But since no law firm has a business growth strategy department and no client ever views their lawyer that way, I just go with traditional titles like, yeah, I'm an M&A and deals lawyer. But really, what got me to that place is a devout and genuine, authentic fascination with the dynamics and challenges of business growth. Does that make sense?
It totally makes sense. And I, you know, that's the point of the book that I'm writing, is that it's the war and art of funding. There is a battle that goes on internally inside of an entrepreneur, right? So should I sell? Do I want to have a new boss? Should I, should I take this deal? Am I being taken advantage of? And you're an entrepreneur's advocate, right? That's what you do.
100%. I mean, anyone who knows me knows that I will step in front of the train for any entrepreneurial client. And I mean that metaphorically and probably literally. I would like to think of myself as a champion of entrepreneurship, you know, from policy perspective. I've testified before Congress. I mean, you know, our nation's ability to grow entrepreneurial wealth is something very, very near and dear to me. And again, back to your point, if you think about entrepreneurial wealth over the last 50 years, most of it has been grown through M&A on the sell side, and sometimes M&A on the buy side for a while until there's a sell transaction. So, trillions of dollars of wealth has been created in this country over the last 50 years by entrepreneurial visionaries who build something of value that someone else wants to buy and is willing to pay a premium for. And it's, I don't mean to get all philosophical or mushy, but, you know, when your day comes and you're about to get lowered into the ground and you say, what did you stand for? What was your legacy? I'm very happy and proud to make that my legacy.
And you've always responded quickly and kindly and cordially whenever I've reached out. And we are EO, Steve, we're grateful for, you know, how much energy you put into us, because I'm sure I'm not the only one reaching out from time to time.
Well, let's talk about that for a minute. Number one, I do believe that responsiveness is near godliness. I even if I have to respond to somebody to tell them I can't respond, I try and respond quickly, if that makes any sense. But EO, you know, has a very, very special place in my heart. I worked with Vern to file the Articles of Incorporation for EO in 1988. It was then YEO. I have been the outside general counsel to the Entrepreneurs Organization since 1988 and still am today. I have a longer relationship with EO than I even have as a father of two children. And I've been married just slightly longer than I've been EO's general counsel. So not only do I take responsiveness very seriously, but if it's an EO member, if it's a member of the EO family, the EO tribe, you're going to get even more responsiveness, even more empathy and passion and advocacy because of how seriously I take the EO network and my relationship to it. It's you know, quite frankly, one of my proudest professional accomplishments is being the outside general counsel of the EO.
And thank you. We really appreciate that. And Vern is a friend as well. You know, he's obviously teaching people his whole thing, but I want to stick with this M&A. So why would somebody look to get acquired? You know, and a lot of times it's because they didn't plan and suddenly they have a crisis. Is that the majority of the times, or is it people are getting forced? Like in SPACs, for example, I know of situations, and I personally was involved with one, where you get threatened to get taken over, and you didn't want to do that. Are acquisitions typically for people who are unprepared, or have many people meticulously prepared for that one day of being acquired?
Steve, it's an extremely astute and insightful question. And the way to answer it properly is to literally create a T-chart, okay? And on one side of the T-chart would be positive reasons to sell your business, and on the other side of the T-chart would be negative variables that drive the sale of the business. And they're equally populated on the T-chart. Like if you said to me, you know, of the hundreds and hundreds of deals you've done over your 35-year career, please, you know, populate the T-chart. On the negative side of the T-chart, I would have personal health and sickness. I would have retirement. I would have competitive pressures. I would have inability to recruit and retain and train people. I would have, you know, dinosaur business models and products and services and, you know, shrinking margins and broken supply chains. On the positive side, I would have, you know, fantastic momentum. There's one I call the fly in the underpants, which is where a growing entrepreneurial company is a real irritant in a good way to its bigger competitors, and the bigger competitors need to buy them to get rid of the fly in the underpants. You know, harvesting your intangible assets and building your brands properly, building loyal and durable. Let me repeat that. Customer base. You know, building a great database and AI and big data in ways that big competitors need to buy you. So it's really, you know, there's no one reason why companies sell. Sometimes it's out of need and sometimes it's out of desire. There's the great professor who I'm drawing a blank on his name, but he says, do you want to be king or do you want to be rich? And if you want to be king, mm-hmm. then you'll hold on to your business, you know, forever, even if it goes into rapid decline because you get to be king. But if you want to be rich, you'll build an enterprise that others admire and that others want to buy, whether they're financial buyers or strategic buyers.
Hmm. Yeah. And that makes sense. Unfortunately, most of us as entrepreneurs define our lives about the creativity of our business. Like we use that as our canvas and that's how we define ourselves. So,
but here's the most important thing I'm going to say on your podcast. Okay. What many entrepreneurs, including many EO members, never figure out ever is when it comes to M&A, it's not about you. It's about them. And so you can be as creative as you want. You can be, you know, pursuing as many different projects. You might suffer from bright, shiny object syndrome and be pursuing all kinds of product development. But at the end of the day, people buy your business because of where it strategically fits with them, not you. Mm. It's not about you. And I've had this fight with so many entrepreneurial leaders and like, well, my business does this and my customers and my employees. And like, you got to get out of that mindset, because if you want to sell, you need to project your business through the eyes of the buyer, not through the eyes of the seller. And if you think about building your business in a way that, you know, you define, all right, here are my top, you know, one day I might sell. And at least at the moment, these are my top five prospective buyers. What can I do every day to add enterprise value in a manner that those five top target buyers would find valuable. And so many entrepreneurs do not build their business in that fashion.
Right.
And that's where they're leaving sometimes tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars on the table. And it drives me batty because you know how many entrepreneurs I meet from day one. They're like, my goal is to sell my business. Like, okay, well, then let's build the business that people want to buy.
Yeah, for sure. And that's what we miss, right? Is we're not prepared. We're going into the urgent and important zone or crisis mode when we're getting acquired for many of us. And so I'll put you on the spot here for a moment. Could you share a story about a company that was well prepared to get purchased and did really well in the acquisition and everybody lived happily ever after? Do you have a story like that?
Yeah, I can't use names because I'm governed by attorney-client privilege. And the problem is many of the private deals are not reportable. You know, they're not reported as public knowledge. So I can't go, the ExxonMobil merger, which now, of course, thousands of articles have been written about. Although I did work loosely on the post-closing matters tied to ExxonMobil. So at least that one. I can talk about a little, but let's take two quick stories. One company was in the biopharma industry. They had early on identified their target buyers. They tried to mimic the governance and corporate structure, even the org structure. You know, they were constantly thinking, what would big pharma want to see from us from an FDA regulatory perspective, from an org chart perspective, from and you'll relate to this, Steve, from a cap table perspective. They were careful not to bring in any difficult investors that would be jerks on a a pre-closing basis. I mean, they literally walked in the shadows of big pharma. And sure enough, they sold to big pharma at a price that ended up being 6 to 8 times more than the seller thought he was going to get. 6 to 8 times more. So that's as much as I can say about that one. Another company that we worked with much more recently, and all I'll say is EO member from the southwestern part of the United States, because that's as much as I'll know. But that company also understood its buyers very well, made itself very attractive. Not only was he a fly in the underwear of many of these companies, so I've used that metaphor twice, but he was also kind of perpetually the prettiest girl at the dance. You know, I say that not in a sexist way. I'm saying the person that everyone wanted to dance with, you know, at the middle school prom. And by doing that, he was always on the radar screen of buyers. He understood branding. He understood social media. He did a couple of industry podcasts. I mean, he got it. And so when it was time to sell, it was such an easy transition. Like, I was reaching out to some of the target buyers, and I would be literally, Steve, mid-sentence in describing the company, and they would go, oh, no, we know that company. We know that guy. You know, so those are at least two quick stories that I hope your listeners find useful without disclosing client confidences on things you can do if you're thinking of selling, even if it's 3 to 5 years from now. You know, but walk a mile in the shoes of your buyer. Look at your company through the eyes of the buyer. I mean, take it seriously. Getting ready to sell your business is almost a full-time job in addition to the job you have in running your business.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's for sure. So did these companies set the stage before they sold? Did they know they were setting the stage? Was it something that just happened to happen, or was it totally intentional?
It was mostly intentional. There were a few hiccups. One of the companies had to go through an FTC antitrust review in the middle of a government shutdown. One of the companies had a quarter come in that was a little disappointing, so we put it on hold for a bit, and then revisited the marketplace after a follow-up quarter was a much stronger. But remember, you know, back to the very, very, very beginning of this show, if intangible assets are going to be the drivers of enterprise value, particularly for small and mid-sized companies, and this one, I hope you're sitting down for this, then will EBITDA be dead sometime soon as a, you know, as a multiple of enterprise value? Because, you know, so many of these companies are being sold with negative EBITDA or non-existent EBITDA or multiples off the charts. So, you know, the more you can focus on your intangibles, the more you can focus on the strategic positioning of your company, the less relevant the financial performance of the company is. I mean, it's always going to be relevant, but I don't know that some multiple of EBITDA is the best way to define enterprise value, you know, over the next 5 to 10 to 15 years when it comes to small and mid-sized company M&A. I mean, how many deals can you think of that you've seen in the last 3 to 5 years where EBITDA became less and less and less relevant?
Right. Exactly. And as you said, many companies are subject to not keeping up with the times. They become dinosaurs. And ultimately, I would imagine that these people who are doing, or these companies that are doing the acquisitions, are companies who have kept current or have some sort of an edge, and they're looking to apply that edge to the company that they're acquiring in order to have an exponential return on their investment.
That's right. And you know, but there again, let's put ourselves back in the shoes of the seller preparing for their business over the next couple, sell the business over the next few years. If you believe EBITDA is going to be the sole determinant of value, then you're going to run your business to maximize profitability. But if you believe that EBITDA is becoming less relevant, then you're going to run your business to grow intangible assets. And those might be two very different sets of business decisions, very different sets of business strategies, very different sets of business models, very different capital needs. I mean, you as leader of the company have to decide if you think EBITDA is going to be the most relevant variable, then yeah, you go ahead and run your business as if EBITDA is everything. But you might be in for an unpleasant surprise if you're, you know, if the value of the enterprise is lower than it could have been had you focused on building intangible assets.
Exactly. So artificial intelligence, for example, is a huge opportunity in every company, at least to some degree. And the fact is that I would imagine 99.9% of companies have not engaged in any sort of artificial intelligence interaction. Like, they're not even ready for it.
Right. But what if in a world, I totally agree with you, but what if in a world a couple of years from now, a lack of an AI strategy ends up your company being left behind as irrelevant to many buyers, much in the same way 10 years ago, if you didn't have an e-commerce strategy, you would be left behind in the dust by many buyers because, you know, that was, it's like today, being up for sale and telling your buyers, oh, we don't have a social media strategy. We don't believe in social media. I mean, really? Not at all? No online branding? I mean, that's a little much.
That's the truth. Yeah. So setting the stage really means when you're looking to be acquired, perhaps, or at least get approached as being relevant, being prepared, trying to at least incorporate some of your modern technology into your business, and also being aware of who your acquirers could be so you can kind of gussy up or dress yourself up to be very attractive to them. That would probably be a strategy that entrepreneurs could use that probably don't think about that.
I agree. I mean, but you know, what I'm really hoping is that people are listening to the podcast and reading this chapter of the book with a focus on, you know, the next 3 to 5 years. And that, you know, I mean, if the sale of your business is imminent, Yes, there's a few things we can do, you know, if we all work together, but, you know, these are processes that need to be put in place and sustainable and durable. And, you know, it's hard to kind of, you know, 2 weeks before you're selling your business to suddenly reshift with an intangible asset focus. But what I do suggest for many of our clients is, if you have time, do a pre-sale, you know, mock due diligence or intangible asset audit, so that at least you identify and extract the intangibles capable of harvesting before your buyer finds them in the due diligence process and then doesn't even disclose to you what they found.
Yeah, that's probably usually the case, right? You're selling it based upon a formula that's in your, you know, in the industry, but they've got a special widget that's going to provide oodles of value for them. And that typically doesn't come to the table unless you're aware and well equipped to address that.
Exactly.
Got it. Okay. So, you know, we met at the MIT program, was my first interaction with you. You told a story about Tide and how Tide was getting, you know, beat up by shareholder movements to use that Tide name, color, and so on to do Tide sticks and to do Tide laundry facilities, you know, washer dryer places and such. And I just found it fascinating.
And even now, dry cleaners, they have a talk about the ultimate leveraging of a brand. You know, there's all kinds of variations of the Tide line of products now in the supermarket, but you can literally get your dry cleaning done at franchise Tide branded dry cleaners. I mean, you know, what they did was genius. And I use the Tide example to, you know, you don't have to be Procter & Gamble to mimic Procter & Gamble or any of the big Fortune 500 strategies. You know, small and mid-sized companies can do their own version of Tide leveraging. And no, you don't have three generations of advertising behind your brands, but it doesn't mean that the strategy can't or won't work.
Exactly. And that's the mindset. Now I understand why you said these two books need to be put together when you're looking for M&A opportunities, as well as for you know, just future growth of your business, because it's ultimately important for you to understand where those other values are, those pots of gold are inside of your business.
Exactly. They're inextricably intertwined, to quote the Supreme Court, and, you know, one becomes a driver for growth and enterprise value to the other. I mean, ultimately, if you're on the sell side, you're looking to sell at the maximized enterprise value and the best terms and the best price. And if you're on the buy side, you're looking for these insights to, you know, find hidden gems and gold nuggets in the haystack and leverage those assets that you paid a dollar for and turn them into $10 assets a couple of years after closing. So it does meet, you know, both ends of the spectrum.
Excellent. Well, you know, again, the name of those books are Harvesting Intangible Assets, Uncover Hidden Revenue in Your Company's Intellectual Property, author, our very own Andrew Sherman, and then Mergers and Acquisitions from A to Z. And I do see that there's a number of versions of this book, and obviously the most current is the most relevant, wouldn't you say?
Yes. I mean, the others are at this point collector's items, but if you're on the Amazon site considering order them, just check and make sure you're ordering the most recent editions.
Got it. Would that be 2018 on the M&A side?
Yes.
Excellent. Very good. And it's on Audible to take us ADD entrepreneurs and allow us just to listen, have somebody else read to us. Wonderful. All right. Well,
fantastic.
Andrew, thank you so much.
Steve, excellent questions. This was just such an enjoyable interview, and I hope that your listeners enjoy it as much as I think you and I did producing it. So do you want me to share my contact information? If anybody has further questions, I'm happy to help.
Absolutely. Yeah, please do.
Yeah. You can hit me up by email at asherman@seyfarth.com, or give me a call at 202-828-5381.
Beautiful. Andrew, from the bottom of my heart, from an entrepreneur, from EO, and just from, you know, a human perspective, we really appreciate you. Thank you so much for all the good work that you do.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on the show.
You've been listening to the Pitchology Podcast. We invite you to check out the Pitchology course and workshop online, along with other helpful content at pitchology.ai. That's .ai, not .com. Thank you for joining us today.